Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. A judge puts on hold the controversial voting law known as SB 3, which some say has led to confusion. The two major party candidates for governor debate the issues on stage, and federal prosecutors in Hillsborough County toughen up penalties for fentanyl dealers. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we're going to talk about them this hour. And this discussion would be incomplete without you. Give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, and Jeff Feingold of NH Business Review. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for being here.
Morning.
Good morning. Peter.
And listeners, we're also broadcasting a live video of this radio show today. You can watch it at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Again, the phone number for you to join the conversation is 1-800-892-6477. Now let's jump right into the discussion, the stories about SB 3. It was all over the news this week. That's the controversial law that some say made it harder for certain groups of people like college students and homeless people to register to vote close to Election Day. Advocates say the law plugged gaps in the state's election law, made it harder for people to cast fraudulent votes. This week, Hillsborough County Superior Court Judge Kenneth Brown ruled against the law, saying it imposes additional burdens on legitimate voters. So that's where the fight began. But Dave, maybe you can unpack the sort of timeline from this week, because that decision was on Monday. What was the rationale behind that decision?
Well, the rationale behind the decision articulated by the judge in his order was that he was more convinced by the arguments of the League of Women Voters and the State Democratic Party that the wording of this affidavit that the voters without identification would be asked to sign was complicated, was difficult to follow, would tie up election lines, and was unnecessary because the judge said he was not convinced by the state's argument that such measures were needed to offset the danger of fraudulent voting. The judge was not convinced that there was a real problem big enough to be solved by the measures that were proposed in the law. But it's important to note that this was only a ruling on a temporary injunction to forestall implementation of the law pending a full trial on the merits. So it's not like the law was struck down.
Right.
It was just, we're going to put it on hold for now because we have to have a trial. So if this is unresolved, we shouldn't put it in effect because the plaintiffs have met the requirement that they have a likely enough chance of succeeding at trial that we should allow the law to take effect. Because if we allow it to take effect and then they succeed, that would kind of defeat the purpose of the trial. It's important, though, to put this in context for the hundreds of thousands of people who are going to go to the polls a week from Tuesday, who, if they're following the coverage of this, might think there's going to be mass confusion and hundreds of thousands of people voting process is going to be complicated. This law affects a very narrow segment of the voting population, which is those people who arrive at the polls without sufficient photo identification to establish their identity and their residency in New Hampshire. And that's of 750,000 votes that were cast in the 2016 election, only 9,000 people filled out those affidavits that are in place now. They filled out a card that said, I attest that I live at this location and I am this age. Most of those people were sent a card in the mail after the election, and all but 740 were returned. Even at 9,000 people, that may vote without proper ID. We're talking about almost only about 1% of the voting population that's going to be affected. And what this law does is it tightens up the verification process. Under the existing law, if you go and vote without ID, you fill out this form and the state sends a card to the address that you provided. If you fill out that card and return it, everything's fine. You've been verified. What the new law does is it puts the burden on the voter who fills out that form to come back within 10 days with the proper identification or face voter fraud charges and a possible fine of up to $5,000. And the judge mm-hmm. found that was just too onerous and said they need to go back to the old form where they just mail out the postcard.
Okay,
yeah,
Dean?
Yeah, I want to just add that this law has been looked at for a while now in a variety of different contexts. And originally, as you mentioned, if you did not comply with the requirements under SB 3, you were subject to something like a $5,000 or $6,000 fine. About a year ago, I think that part of the law was put on hold. So SB 3 was allowed to go into effect, I think, for 2017, but not the fine. So now this is for the rest of it as well.
Right. So to get back to your original question, Peter, about the sequence of events this week, this legal challenge has been working its way through the courts since shortly after the law was passed in the summer of 2017. And there was a trial underway with Judge Temple in Nashua. And in fact, it was Judge Temple just before the elections in 2017 who said, well, we're going to have to suspend the fines while this works its way through the courts. And they would have been set up to bring this to trial in early 2018, if not for the fact that the state went out and hired an attorney who had had some prior relationship with Judge Temple, and then he had to recuse himself earlier this year. And so basically they had to start all over again and really put themselves in a time crunch. So when the judge issued his injunction on Monday, the state later appealed. And then yesterday, the judge Brown heard their appeal, and they worked out some conditions that would clarify exactly how they should proceed using the older documents. The state is still dissatisfied with that. They've appealed to the Supreme Court of the state to essentially put a stay on the Judge Brown's decision and let them move forward with the new verification forms. And we'll probably hear the Supreme Court ruling on that later today.
Jeff, you wanted to comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to say one. When you listen to Dave's details on this, the irony is, if it's possibly palpable, it is, because this is supposed to simplify things and make things easier in this process, and it's become just a crazy situation now where we're down to the last, to the wire on an election, a very important election, as everybody's been saying for a long time now, and we have this situation, we're waiting for the Supreme Court to rule perhaps this afternoon, we don't know. It's very instructive on why they call it like sausage making.
Yeah, and the current compromise that they worked out is something like you use the new form under SB 3 up until Election Day, and on Election Day they go back to the 2016 form, and then on top of that the Secretary of State's office or the AG said, well, we're not going to do anything right now until we see what the Supreme Court says, so just everything is basically up in the air.
Okay. I rest my case.
Yeah. So want to bring in an interesting voice on this particular issue because Durham checklist supervisor Ann Shump said making any last-minute changes to the registration process will be a challenge, but SB 3, she says, would have caused even more headaches on Election Day. And she, by the way, had testified against the law in court.
It's going to be some work to get ready because we have to change what kind of registration forms we're using and change how we're going to train our volunteers a little bit. But we're still happy about this.
So commenting, of course, earlier in the week on this, but it seems like the perspective on the ground, at least from some people, is that this is a good thing. SB 3 would have been a little burdensome. Jeff?
Yeah, I think that's the opponents have seized on this, really, this case to kind of say, well, look, this bill apparently it's already had flaws. The fine was actually stayed, and now we're talking about these other problems that Judge Brown has seen in this. It does kind of make you wonder, was the state putting the cart before the horse by after seeing these rulings? And as Dave said earlier about the delay in getting their lawyer and getting their case set up, was it really necessary to have this law take effect for this election? And why weren't things cleaned up first before they decided to go with what this law said? I mean, I'm just saying this as an observer of this.
Yeah, and it's interesting too that, you know, this particular the evolution of the story this week had to do not with small technical things, but with the heart of the issue, right? Is this imposing burdens on people like students, people like homeless people? Governor Sununu, in the debate this week with Molly Kelly, which we'll get to elsewhere in the program, did comment on this. He stood by the what he signed into law, and he said he likes that it adds new proof of residency requirements.
You got to get through the political aspects of this and just make sure that we have integrity in our system. We are the first in the nation primary. You have to have integrity.
But Molly Kelly said there was no need for this.
I think the laws that we've had in New Hampshire are absolutely have worked. And as the courts had said, we are going to go back to where we were before.
So Governor Sununu calling for getting politics out of this in a way, but
The essence of this entire debate is politics. It goes back a couple years. It's this ongoing debate we're having about whether or not voter fraud is a significant issue in our electoral politics. It's something that President Trump made a big issue of in the 2016 election, talking about the election potentially being rigged and lots of people voting illegally. We've looked at New Hampshire. Secretary of State has said there's no evidence of systemic voter fraud. Governor Sununu, when he ran for governor, had made some comments about thousands of people coming up here to vote. He has since stepped away from that. But nonetheless, the issue is we've created this kind of complex web of state laws to deal with a problem that everyone is saying, based on empirical data, is not a big problem. And I just think that's unfortunate. And it raises the issue of whether or not this leads to some form of voter suppression. And that's the essence of what you're talking about. Yeah. Is this voter suppression?
That's a really good point, is that this is not just it's not an isolated incident in New Hampshire. It's just happening all across the country in different ways, different kinds of bills, different kinds of
states
fights.
Are doing all kinds of changes to their voter laws because of this.
And New Hampshire's been a part of this fight for, I'd say, at least in the last part of the decade. I mean, since I'd say at least since 2010 or so, it's been part of something in the legislature to try to do this, to change the laws to what some people think would be make them better, and others think it's onerous or bordering on suppression.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's important to put this in the context in two ways. One is that the governor and the secretary of state are fond of stating on several occasions that New Hampshire is the only state in the country that even allows same-day registration or registration within 30 days of an election without a proper ID by only filling out an affidavit. But they neglect to explain that is not out of the goodness of our heart. That is because of a consent decree that the state accepted with the federal government 25 years ago when Congress passed the motor voter law, and New Hampshire was one of only two states that refused to adopt it. The motor voter law, of course, set up the opportunity for voters to register basically any time they interact with state government at the Department of Motor Vehicles, when signing up for benefits and so forth. New Hampshire didn't want to do that for a variety of reasons, so they had to come up with these other ways to accommodate voters. And if New Hampshire doesn't want to have same-day registration, wants to require registration 30 days of advance of election, wants to require you to go to the, you know, then all they have to do is adopt motor voter. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is the state, governor and the attorney general expressing outrage that this decision has been rendered so close to the election is somewhat disingenuous, since they just completed a two-week a hearing on the injunction in September, and it was fairly obvious to everyone that the ruling was going to come out right around election time. That was the whole point of the hearing, so that they could get a ruling out ahead of the election. Everyone knew it was coming, so the fact that the Secretary of State, probably under the advice of the Attorney General, did nothing to prepare for the contingency that the ruling might be overturned has raised the question in the minds of a lot of people that it seemed somewhat arrogant to assume that your position was going to prevail and that you needed to make no accommodation for the possible other outcome.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We'd love to hear from you if you have questions or comments about the week's news. In just a moment, we're going to discuss the gubernatorial debate you may have heard on Wednesday night on NHPR Live between the two major party candidates for governor, incumbent Republican Chris Sununu and Democrat Molly Kelly. And we want to know from you regarding this debate, which candidate made the biggest impression on you, especially if you were undecided and you listened to try and make up your mind? Give us a call. Let us know. Did either candidate change your mind, bring you into their camp? Our number is 1-800-892-6477, or you can send us an email exchange@nhpr.org. While we're on the subject of voting issues, I wanted to ask you about what's been called inadvertent data entry mistakes by the Secretary of State's office, which are being blamed for 146 incorrect absentee ballots that were sent to voters in five New Hampshire towns. That was according to a review by the Attorney General's office. Dave, what happened with these ballots?
Well, according to the Attorney General's office, they chalked it up to a simple matter of a data entry error in preparing the ballots. Some individual has to go down the row of primary results, who won, who lost, and translate that into the actual ballot for every one of the several hundred precincts in the state, and many different ballots, three different kinds of absentee ballots, for example, for each location. And in so doing, some names got transposed. Someone who was the fourth place finisher in a race for four seats and should have been on the ballot ended up being off the ballot, and the fifth person was on. So someone looked down a line, skipped a line by mistake, and made a data entry error. These were all caught in enough time to send out the proper ballot, because these were all absentee ballots that we're talking about. And so no voter cast an improper ballot, but the Democrats, particularly people running against the Secretary of State for that office, have tried to make quite a big deal out of this.
Jeff?
Yeah, I was going to say that this and that SB3 debate is really shining a light on another election that's going to be taking place after the election, and that's the race for Secretary of State. Colin Van Oster, in particular, has former candidate for governor, Democratic candidate for governor, has said he's challenging Secretary of State Gardner, who's been basically Secretary of State for life, mm-hmm. as far as anybody can remember. He's the Secretary of State, and he's mounting a challenge that most people think it's quixotic, but he is making very strong points. And these kind of incidents are helping to reaffirm that, you know, his criticism of the Secretary of State, not necessarily that it's all valid, but it is affirming that he said, well, there's a reason. These are legitimate incidents that are happening. And, you know, what's the explanation? And in many cases, there's not much response from the Secretary of State's office. Although we did in my paper in the Business Review, we ran an op-ed by Colin Van Ostern, and the Secretary of State's office replied to that, and it actually appears in this current issue, and they did respond. It wasn't the Secretary of State himself; it was an Assistant Secretary of State.
Yeah, and the thing to know there is essentially the gamble, so to speak, is that Colin Van Ostern has this organization, Free and Fair New Hampshire, and it's putting out a lot of proposals about how he would change the Secretary of State's office. And the gamble there is that by supporting Democratic candidates, if the House swings Democratic in the next election, then in December he may have sufficient support in the legislature to get elected as Secretary of State. I think it's a challenging undertaking, but he's been quite active in it for some time now.
He's been raising a lot of money, and actually, the Secretary of State is a Democrat, by the way, so that's what makes it even more interesting.
Mm-hmm. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We're speaking with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review, and the union leaders Dave Solomon. And with you, we hope, give us a call if you want to weigh in on the gubernatorial debate that we had last on Wednesday. It was Wednesday night. 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dave Solomon of The Union Leader, Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-799-4477. The major party gubernatorial candidates met for a few debates recently. We're going to talk about their campaigns, their stance on the issues. Please do weigh in if you have a thought about this. 1-800-892-6477, or comment on our Facebook page where you can watch a live video of this radio broadcast. That's NHPR Exchange. So the candidates met. They spoke about a variety of issues. Paid family medical leave keeps coming up. And on the debate between Molly Kelly and Chris Sununu on Wednesday night on NHPR, they had an exchange about paid family medical leave.
Obviously, the governor, when this was being vetted and it was passed through the House three times through the House, he had a majority of his own party in the House and the Senate. If he wanted to put through a paid family medical leave act, that was the time to do it. He didn't do it. He had an opportunity to do it and later called it a vacation. I, as governor, will ensure that we do pass
we've
a paid
created a
family
whole,
medical
look, I think
leave
it's only fair to
Governor,
say,
I'm going to give you 30 seconds to respond to what Senator Kelly said,
all,
and then I want to move
there's
400
members
on. Did you call it a vacation?
It's not a vacation. Let's be very clear. It's obviously not a vacation. That comment came as part of a bigger conversation. Of course it's not a vacation. That's silly. At the end of the day, when their plan, we realized it was a trap of an income tax. We tried through the Lynn Ober Amendment. We tried to support that. That didn't get passed. I don't control the whole House.
So a trap income tax, according to the governor. Jeff, you want to respond to this?
Yeah, I find it interesting that this has become a big issue. And actually, it's apparently Molly Kelly's main issue. I mean, she's been going all over about this thing. The bill that was debated and voted on last session was basically a bill that ended up having what they call an opt-in. As an employee, you could say, I want to be part of this family medical leave program, and they would take something out of your paycheck, just like unemployment insurance, that have same kind of fund for that. And apparently what happened is that the Department of Revenue Administration ran some numbers, and they said, well, you know, if it's opt-in, it's probably not going to be as financially viable as it should be. They raised questions about it. And after being passed, as Senator Kelly said, in the House three times, it goes to the Senate, and it seemed like it might be getting through. The supporters were very optimistic about it, but the governor, who had been pretty quiet throughout the session, said he was against it, and that's what happened was that the bill just, you know, did not make it. And the real concern, though, the real problem was that with this opt-in provision, it almost was like it wasn't enough. And now the governor apparently is saying that he supports some kind of voluntary proposal, which I haven't seen any details of, really. It's kind of this idea that he does support it, but it's not clear what he does support, you know, what kind of family and medical leave program he does support, because he says he does, and he doesn't support a voluntary one, but that's pretty much what the opt-in was.
There's a difference between voluntary and opt-in?
Well, no, an opt-in is voluntary. It's you have to opt into this program to be part of it.
Well, the way it was initially designed, and this was the heart of the governor's concern, is that you were automatically going to be in it and automatically have, I don't know, $5 to $9 a week deducted from your paycheck automatically unless you opted out. Mm-hmm. And the provision for opting out required you to fill out a form that would be notarized. So the governor criticized it as an income tax because it would come out of your check, so it's a tax on your income if you didn't opt out, and the opt-out provisions were too onerous in his view. And using the bully pulpit to make that point, the bill was voted down, even though it appeared on the glide path to passage. What the governor has made clear that he supports is a version that was actually proposed in committee by Republican Representative Lynn Ober, which would essentially be go to the private market for short-term disability insurance with help from the state, meaning get local find insurance companies that want to offer short-term disability. The state will help facilitate the payment of the premium and let the private insurers handle it. What you're going to have then is a very expensive premium because, you know, in programs like that, people only buy them when they think they're going to use them. And when the only people who buy insurance are the people who are going to use it, guess what? It's extremely expensive. So this is the debate. that is underway on this insurance program. And in a way, it's a microcosm of the debate we're having on all insurance programs, whether it's health insurance, short-term disability, or family medical leave. Do you want a mandatory program where everyone's in the pool, even many people who may never use the program, and therefore the costs are low for those who need it? Or do you want to have a program that's entirely optional, where only people who need it are going to buy it, and it's going to be very expensive?
Well, the other aspect of this with using a private insurance is the fact that these people are leaving their jobs temporarily, and what happens to the employer? What's the employer's option? What is the employer, he or she, supposed to do when this employee is out for a week, 2 weeks, a month, whatever the leave is necessary? What happens to that physician, especially if you're a small business? This has been a concern for a long time. How would this actually work?
Yeah, and just to take a step back, you know, what you heard in that particular clip was part of a larger campaign strategy by Sununu to paint Molly Kelly as a tax and spender, using words like income tax. Yeah. Molly Kelly has taken the pledge not to have a sales or income tax increase, but Sununu has argued, if you look at her record in the Senate, that she's actually a tax and spender. That's going to be his argument. You know, more broadly speaking, Sununu, you know, is in reasonably good shape. He's up by about 10 points in each of the St. A's and the UNH polls. It may be a little closer than that in the end, but he's got high approval. So this is a challenge for Molly Kelly. She's going to need some help from a blue wave, I think, on this one.
Yeah, let's hear a little bit of the exchange that Sununu and Kelly had about taxes. Sununu did criticize Kelly for raising taxes many times during her time in the Senate, after she said she would not support a sales or income tax, and that she voted to cut taxes for small businesses.
Her own words said very clearly to the Keene Sentinel, when it comes to a sales and income tax, I think everything should be on the table. Those are her words, not mine. So I know it sounds convenient that now that she's running for governor, oh, well, she's going to take the pledge and not raise those taxes. But let's be fair. I'm sure she didn't tell her constituents she was going to raise them 50 to 60 times when she ran for Senate, but she did that. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to be responsible. I cut business taxes. I eliminated the electricity consumption tax. This is how you drive business and create opportunity for individuals.
Okay, so Senator, do you want to respond?
Sure. You know, let me be clear once again that I do not support and would veto a sales and income tax. And in response to my opponent's language here about taxes, you know, every time we are in a discussion, and it has happened to me with my opponent and certainly with the Republican Party, that when we're not quite sure how to answer certain questions or we don't want to know how to move forward or support policy, we bring up, you know, the political fear tactic, which is taxes. And it continues to be brought up all the time.
It's a fact, though. It's not a fear tactic. Let's be honest.
I believe that our voters are tired of hearing that, and I believe that our voters are much smarter than to continue to hear that same rhetoric, which is really a complete political fear tactic.
So Molly Kelly says bringing up this issue, this tax issue, is a fear tactic, though Sununu seems to be saying, look, you've shifted your position a little bit.
Yeah. Perfect encapsulation of what I was talking about. That's the Republican strategy. It's a tried and true classic.
It's the playbook.
Greatest hits, absolutely. So
she shouldn't be surprised about it.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You could just fill in the blank for the opponent's name, and it's the same.
Right, and she should be prepared for them to mine her record as a state legislator to be able to deal with whatever they might throw at her in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. We did a questionnaire with the two major party candidates for governor, and we asked a question about business taxes. And apparently, Senator Kelly, who at one point had said she would get rid of the reductions in the business profits tax and the business enterprise tax, changed her mind in our questionnaire and said that she would keep the business enterprise tax cuts, but still would try to roll back the cuts in the business profits tax. And that was, you know, that was an interesting change in her position that apparently was reflected a little bit slightly in this debate. But it's apparent that the idea of taxes is a moving issue for her. She's still not clear on her positions on it. And this is what, just a few days away from the election, and she's still kind of feeling around what her overall stances on some of these
things.
And
the other issue that you raised earlier, Jeff, and I've said this before on the show, is that there's a little bit of a danger in being seen as a single-issue candidate.
Yeah.
And, you know, for all the importance of the family medical leave to Democrats, and it may very well be something that mobilizes Democrats, you know, you want to make a more complete picture of yourself as a candidate, to particularly for independent voters or maybe other voters who don't know you as well. You know, she ran heavily on her biography in the primaries, but it's been pretty much straight family medical leave since she got the nomination.
Yeah, I mean, it was something I guess we'll talk about later, that Wayfair decision. It seemed to me that that would be something she would use as some kind of rebuttal on the governor's big stance against sales taxes and stuff. I mean, here's a possibility of New Hampshire residents like paying a sales tax.
She's just shifting to education now. I think she has a new ad out about vouchers or something like that. But you know, we're in the home stretch.
Yeah. There's one more thing from the debate that we should listen to. The two candidates clashed on the best way to solve state issues without burdening citizens. And Molly Kelly said her most consequential bill that she pushed through the Senate was the net metering bill, which she argued was bipartisan and would benefit many, including manufacturers and businesses.
I was so disappointed when my opponent vetoed that an expansion of that bill, throwing a wet blanket on moving forward with renewable energy, in particular solar and hydro in our state.
All right,
go ahead.
I want to give you 30 seconds on that, and then we'll move on to mental health.
The net metering bill that I vetoed, thank goodness it was sustained, because it would have cost the state over $200 million over the next 10 years. $200 million. And who pays that? Low-income families, the elderly, those on fixed incomes? Those, it's a regressive tax. Those are the folks that bear the cost. And who? What was that bill going to do? Make these giant 30-acre solar arrays, and big developers would reap the profits. I love the concept. I'm an environmental engineer. I've worked on these projects. I've worked on more renewable energy projects than any governor in history. The way you, if you're going to invest in solar power, that's a great idea, but you got to put it exactly where with the folks that can get the biggest benefit. Low-income families, the elderly, those on fixed incomes, those are the folks that should have the solar power on their homes, not giant arrays so the developers can put money in their back pocket.
So variations on a theme here. Another way that Governor Sununu is saying, look, I've cut expenses for Granite Staters in a variety of ways, and here is another list of ways I've done that, Dean.
Yeah, and that's particularly in the energy field. That's a important challenge for him. You know, there have been a lot of discussion in recent months about Sununu kind of shifting explicitly away from a focus on renewables and focusing more on the actual cost of energy and whether or not that may mean increasing the supply of natural gas into the state. And I believe in the debate there was a question about whether or not you would support a pipeline. And I think he said yes, and she said maybe. Wasn't sure. So the energy debate in the state has been recast a bit as a debate about cost rather than simply percentage of renewables. And I think that's something that Sununu has done very intentionally. And what you just heard there was kind of an extension of that, recasting how we think about the role of not simply that we need more renewables, but kind of recasting the debate about the role that they should play in a larger mix of energy.
Yeah, and that number that the governor mentioned, the $200 million cost of net metering, I had never seen a number that high on what the cost of net metering would be, but maybe I didn't read anything.
That is the estimate of the difference in dollars that would be spent on electricity over that 10-year period on the basis of the utilities having to buy this electricity at higher cost from these solar fields than what it would pay on the wholesale market, a higher cost which it then passes along to ratepayers.
An estimate of the higher cost.
An estimate of the higher cost. And I would have to agree with you, the high end of the estimate.
Yes, exactly.
The very high end.
Mm-hmm. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're speaking with our guests today about the week's news. Give us a call if you have questions or comments. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So nationally on the news, we've been hearing a lot about a caravan of migrants making their way to the United States border through Mexico. Now, this is, of course, not surprisingly, a political football. So in light of that, I thought it would be wise to, since we've been talking with the candidates for Congress here on NHPR about a variety of issues. One of those issues was immigration. We've spoken to all of those candidates, all the major party candidates. So I thought we'd hear a little bit about what they'd like to do with respect to immigration. We heard these conversations.
I believe it needs to start with.
And we will start with Chris Pappas. Chris Pappas spoke with NHPR's Rick Ganley about what he thinks needs to be done about immigration.
I believe it needs to start with border security, ensuring that we invest in manpower and in technology along our border to keep this country safe. We need to create a fair and orderly process for people to be able to apply for asylum and safe refuge in this country. And I think we also need to allow the dreamers who know no other country than the United States of America, who are brought here as children, to be able to become citizens of this country. They're here, they're contributing.
So that was Chris Pappas, candidate, Democratic candidate for New Hampshire's 1st Congressional District. His opponent, Republican Eddie Edwards, in his conversation with Rick Ganley, stressed the need for people to come together on the issue of immigration.
I think when it comes to our immigration system, to suggest that somehow the country is not welcoming, I think is disingenuous. We're a very welcoming nation, but you can't come here illegally. So we have to make sure we secure the border. I think that's fair to those who are seeking to come here. And it's also fair to the American worker.
Jeff, let me ask you, because Eddie Edwards ended his comment there with a nod to the American worker and the relationship somehow between businesses and immigration. What do you make of his comment?
Yeah, it seems it just seemed a little dated, I guess, is the right way to say it. I mean, I know that many employers in New Hampshire in particular, specifically, which I know best, but all around the country, have become more and more reliant on workers from other countries. In fact, that's one of the fastest growing part of the New Hampshire's population is people from other countries taking jobs here, mm-hmm. starting businesses. So, you know, to say that, you know, that it's taking jobs from American workers, especially when you see a 2.6% unemployment rate, it seems a little out of sync with what's going on. But the other thing is that we've seen for years that New Hampshire, that employers have had trouble filling jobs with people who, you know, who with Americans, and that they have been more and more looking for people with skills that they can find in other countries. And there are specific visa programs that I know New Hampshire tech employers in particular and manufacturers are using. They call H-1B visas. People with specific skills can come here for a certain specified amount of time to fill jobs as an engineer or whatever it is. The idea of the immigration issue being just specifically on about taking jobs from American workers, I think, especially in this economy, is just not it's just not what it was, you know, like, say, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Dean?
Yeah, well, we know that President Trump thinks that this is a strong issue for him and for Republicans running in certain parts of the country. You know, Chris Pappas mentioned the issue of political asylum, and I think what we're about to see with this caravan is a new debate over political asylum. There's some suggestion that the Trump administration, which has already limited the conditions under which you can ask for asylum at the southern border, may do away with that option completely. We don't know, but this seems like it's going to come to a head right around the election about the whole whether or not people coming from Central America can use certain types of reasons for asking for asylum. Can they even ask for asylum? What happens with the children, as we've seen? So this is a potentially very thorny issue that can cut both ways politically.
Yeah, we're feeling it right here in New Hampshire in a way that I think will gain national recognition because there's going to have to be some resolution of this tension between an extreme labor shortage and a graying population and a more restrictive immigration policy, which has the potential to only exacerbate the problems associated with the graying population and the labor shortage. And I think a canary in the coal mine was the situation in Portsmouth where a well-established restaurant chain had to close, shut down a new restaurant it had just opened a few months ago because it simply couldn't find enough workers to operate the business.
Yeah.
And if we're going to see new business startups fail because they simply can't find enough workers, we're going to see a constriction in economic growth attributed almost entirely to that factor.
Mm-hmm. I want to hear also from the candidates in New Hampshire's 2nd Congressional District on immigration. Annie Custer, speaking with NHPR's Rick Ganley on immigration, looked back on a piece of legislation that she believes had bipartisan support, but never got a debate in the House.
That bill, people forget, had $46 billion to strengthen our borders. And I think that's something that we should do to strengthen our borders. But it also had a pathway to citizenship. It was focused on dreamers, the young people that came here through no fault of their own, that are in school and in jobs and working toward a better life. There's absolutely no reason why we shouldn't come together around immigration reform.
So, Dean, what do you think? Does immigration legislation that includes a pathway to citizenship for dreamers have bipartisan support?
That's a tough question. You know, the reality is that certainly comprehensive immigration reform, but immigration reform in general, it's become such a politically polarizing issue that it's just very difficult to see any compromise on any of this. And it's just, you just get these kind of repeated attempts in Congress by a different parts of either the House or the Senate to come up with a bill, and just getting everybody to agree and to not use it as kind of a political weapon during election season, which is a good chunk of the time these days, because now we're going to get into the next presidential cycle as soon as this midterm is
November
over.
7th,
yeah, it's just become almost an impossibility, and it's really driven by the kind of partisan makeup of Congress. You're going to need one party with a significant majorities in order to really get anything done.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had a compromise that Custer alluded to,
yeah,
which was supported by no less than the Republican presidential candidate at the time, and Senator McCain and Lindsey Graham, yeah, and other prominent Republicans. And the votes appeared to be there, but a massive Contact Your Congressman campaign orchestrated by anti-immigration voices on talk radio and the like mobilized their base, and that was shot down, and that was the last time there was any peep out of Congress about immigration reform.
Jeff?
I'm also not convinced that immigration is at the top of the agenda for typical New Hampshire voters. I think there's other concerns that are far outweigh this, because it's not an issue that we necessarily live with daily. We do, as Dave said, you know, it does affect us economically very much so. But I don't think I think things more like obviously the opioid crisis, the cost of health care, access to health care, other issues are, I think, to me, seem to be weighing more on people's minds than immigration, which seems to be one of these giant national issues that maybe get people riled up on cable news, but maybe not necessarily at their dinner table.
Mm-hmm. That said, let's hear from Steve Negron on this issue. He was asked what he thinks need to be done with immigration, and he said, quote, overarching changes are needed.
I believe right now we need to look at, you know, how do we make sure that the people coming into the border in our country, whether it's through the southern border, even the northern border, seaports, airports, you know, that we're a land of laws. There's a right way to do it. We're not doing it right now. We need to get back to it.
So, Dean, let me ask you your thoughts on the CD2 race at the moment.
Sure. Just in general, you know, this CD2, as I've said, is getting a lot less attention in the news than any other races, which is usually a good sign for the incumbent when the race isn't getting a lot of coverage. You know, Custer in most polling is up double digits. She's enjoying some of the highest favorability of her career, which at one point had been a little bit of an issue for her. She's got a big campaign war chest. She'd raised over $4 million. You know, Steve Negron has some issues with kind of voter recognition and visibility. I think the other concern for him is that second CD has increasingly become more centrist, even leaning slightly Democratic, you know, Concord, Hanover, Lebanon, down to Keene. It's increasingly Democratic. And he has not really adjusted his agenda to kind of meet the demographics of the district. He's very, very conservative on climate change, abortion rights, gay conversion therapy, a number of social issues that I just think make it a little challenging for him to kind of meet up with the demographics of that district. So I think for that race, she's in reasonably good shape.
All right. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. Still to come, Michael Avenatti and Julian Castro, two possible Democratic presidential candidates in the 2020 fight to unseat President Donald Trump. They were in New Hampshire this week. What do you think of them as candidates? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, which is where you can watch a video of this radio show. We'll be back.
Does your mystery machine leave you stranded at the worst possible times?
I think we're in trouble already. Look! Haunted mansion?
If you're terrified by the thought of putting more money into your unreliable vehicle, why not donate it to NHPR and transform it into the programs you love, like All Things Considered and The Exchange, and podcasts like Bear Brook. We'll take care of the paperwork and we'll even tow it away for free. Donate your vehicle today at nhpr.org/cardonation.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Dave Solomon of The Union Leader, Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And with you, give us a call if you have questions or comments, 1-800-892-6477. 800-892-6477. We're going to be talking about 2020 presidential contenders visiting New Hampshire this week. We'll talk about the goings-on with Senator David Woodburn and the Democratic Party up in Coos County. We'll talk about efforts to fight the Wayfair decision in the next few minutes or so. But before we do that, I want to bring in a listener comment about something that was mentioned in the last part of the show. We're talking about wages and immigration and the relationship between, you know, immigration and American workers. And Dave Solomon, you brought up the fact that there was a popular restaurant chain that had to close because it couldn't find enough workers to operate. That restaurant was 900 degrees. And David wrote in to say, 900 degrees is unwilling to pay a livable wage for the Portsmouth area. Rent is high. Cost of living is high. The pay was low. No one could work there and survive, so they chose to close instead of paying a wage they deemed survivable, livable for the community they chose to open up in. Epping, Manchester has cheaper cost of living. David says, simple math, cause and effect. Dave, what do you think of his comments?
Well, if any restaurant has to pay wages sufficient to support an apartment and a lifestyle in Portsmouth proper, I don't think there's any restaurant that could do so except for the highest end restaurants with waiters that make tips in the hundreds of dollars a night. It's the assumption on a part of a lot of Portsmouth employers that their employees won't be living in Portsmouth, that they'll be commuting there from Epping and Rochester and more affordable places. But there's no question about it. Portsmouth is an extremely expensive place to live, and opening a business there is an extremely expensive proposition.
Yeah, it's been an ongoing discussion, I guess, is a mild way of putting it, and especially on the seacoast, but particularly in Portsmouth, and the cost of housing and the inability to have a workforce that actually lives in the city, because it's almost impossible unless you have a really good job to be living there.
Yeah, we got another comment from Tom in Portsmouth who said, part of the reason for the state's labor shortage, put that in quotes, are the low and stagnant wages paid by New Hampshire employers. Tom cites a number. I don't know where he got this number, but he says more than 80,000 New Hampshire workers commute to Massachusetts to work because of higher wages paid in Massachusetts. So thanks, Tom, for your comment. Really appreciate that. Want to get a few more news items in before the end of the hour. Talk about Michael Avenatti, who is the lawyer for porn star Stormy Daniels and her suits against the president. He was in New Hampshire again this week, once again addressing questions about his possible candidacy for president in 2020. And here's what I wanted to ask you gentlemen about. He was quoted in SeacoastOnline.com as saying, quote, what I would ask in 2020 when it comes time to pick a nominee on the Democratic side for the presidency, that you pick a person who has the best shot of beating Donald Trump, not the person in your heart that you would think would make the best president. Dean, what do you make of this campaign message?
That specific statement about picking the person who's most likely to be Donald Trump, I mean, that's kind of standard strategic voting. There's a long history in political science that says that partisans often pick the person they think is most likely to win, who's most viable, rather than the person in their heart who's their true preference. So that's not a particularly controversial thing to say. But the more interesting issue with Avenatti is that he has made comments suggesting that whoever the Democratic nominee is going to have to be prepared to basically punch counterpunch with Trump, get as down and dirty as the president might on the campaign trail. We had the now famous comment by former Attorney General Eric Holder, who said, you know, instead of the Democrats had been saying when they go low, we go high. He's saying, no, when they go low, we have to kick them. And that caused a bit of consternation within the party. So Avenatti is kind of one end of what the debate is going to be among Democrats about how to deal with Trump. Do you have to be really aggressive and hit him back? Do you take the high road or some kind of mix in between? And Avenatti has been very vocal about you have to pick somebody who can just hit Trump back as hard as he hits, even though Trump says he's a famous counterpuncher, Somebody else who can counterpunch in return. But as I said, you know, there's a long history of research showing that voters, they may like one candidate, but they often in the end vote strategically for the member of their party they think is most likely to be able to go toe-to-toe with the incumbent.
But the other thing in that quote that he said was basically said, you don't have to necessarily pick the person who can be the best president. That's kind of really... It's an observation, I guess, on what our system has become, because I really do believe that's really where we're headed now. We have been headed, and I think the election of 2016 shows that people are voting not necessarily based on who they think is most qualified, but they're voting much more emotionally, and that's what Michael Avenatti speaks to. There are certainly members of the voters in the Democratic Party who would love to be able to vote for someone who says he's going to punch harder.
Yeah, but just to be clear, to clarify, what I was talking about is the issue of a voter picking someone who is closest to their ideological ideal point or the ideological position, is not whether or not they're qualified to be president. Yeah. That's a slightly different variant of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
It's just so early in the process.
Yeah.
Historically, I find that there's so many primary contenders that this early we spend a lot of time talking about people who, as you get closer to the actual election day, are going to have faded far into the past. And Avenatti is probably going to be in that faction.
Although, to just one word of warning to you, Dave. That's what we were saying about Donald Trump, but at the same time, two years ago. So let's
except for Bill Maher.
We all ought to bow out of the prediction business, I guess. But let me ask you about Julian Castro, because he was here in New Hampshire this week. He's former Housing and Urban Development Secretary, saying that if he declares a run, it'll be after the first of the year. What do you think about Julian Castro? We'll start with you, Dean.
Yeah, Julian Castro is a former Obama Health and Human Services Secretary. He has a PAC that he has been using to support candidates around the country. He's been increasingly clear that he's likely to run for president. I think he said he's going to make an announcement either after the election or early next year, but it seems pretty likely that he's going to run. And so he certainly is going to be someone who's in the mix. He's been spoken about before. He has a twin brother who I believe is in Congress. There's been some question this cycle about the enthusiasm of Latino voters, and I think he believes that he can tap into that group of voters more forcefully than maybe some other candidates.
Want to ask about another story that made headlines this week. The Union Leader reported, Dave, that the woman who claimed State Senator Jeff Woodburn repeatedly assaulted her has stepped down as chairwoman of the Coos County Democratic Committee after her lawyer maintained she was given the choice of backing Woodburn's election or resigning her post. So, Dave, what is going on in the Coos County Democratic Committee?
It has become a story of domestic violence charges based on a he said, she said premise that has really divided the Democratic Party, the Coos Democratic Party Committee, almost from the day the charges broke. You have probably the most prominent Coos County politician, the state senator, from the area, involved with the head of the Democratic Committee for Coos County in a relationship that both acknowledge was tense and dysfunctional in many ways, and led to confrontations. Whether they constituted criminal domestic violence or not is what is going to have to be adjudicated in the courts. But in the meantime, it's caused a deep split in the party. The woman who has the accuser in this case had to step aside. The interim chairman of the Democratic Party up there tried to get a vote among committee members to express their support for her, and like other Democrats across the state, to separate themselves from Senator Woodburn, who's facing these charges. They couldn't get that vote. It's a case where, as one observer said, everyone involved knows both people, everyone's taken sides, and it's become somewhat of an intractable situation as far as the inner workings of the Democratic Party go in the county. The state party, as represented by the state party chairman, stands firmly behind the decision to urge Woodburn to withdraw, whereas the voters of Coos County have taken a different position. So we'll have to see how it plays out.
Okay, final story we should discuss. We've got a few minutes left to do it. After failing to pass a bill in response to the Supreme Court's Wayfair decision during a special session this summer, the legislature may try again at the governor's request. The governor says the legislature should do more. So what do you think? We'll start with you, Jeff.
Well, this is an issue that just popped up. It didn't really. But after the Supreme Court earlier this year voted, the U.S. Supreme Court said that basically states have the right to collect sales tax on Internet sales.
And when that happened, the governor came out with his
very
fists raised, said, you're going to get a fight.
We're going to have a special session. We're going to have a special session. We're going to address this. And then for reasons that still remain very hazy, they had a special session and the governor wasn't even in town. He was in Aspen. And the session was inconclusive. Nothing came out of it. Now there was a forum just the other day by people, Americans for Prosperity was involved and others, anti-tax groups. And the governor's council basically said, we need to do this with no specific plan or anything. And Dave would know this better than I, but I haven't heard anything about any kind of legislation that's working its way through this yet. I mean, I don't know if there's any kinds. There must be something that's an LSR somewhere, but I don't know. But the point is that there's really this is an issue that was so important when the Supreme Court ruling came out a few months ago, but now it's in a holding pattern that's just it's of all the states in the country to not address this, New Hampshire not addressing it is really curious.
So and to come up now for the governor to push for this now, I mean, is this election related in some way, Dean?
Yeah, maybe. I think this is one of those things that it'll become a problem once it's a problem. There's really almost a sense from the AG, we're as ready as we can be. Let us know if you businesses out there. Let us know if you start to get tax bills. And I think until there's something tangible. Where you can do stories on look what's happening to businesses. It's a little kind of vague at this point.
Yeah.
Well, before we go, I want to give each of you a chance to let us know what you're going to be looking at next week. We'll start with you, Dave Solomon. What's on your reporter's notebook for next week?
I'm going to be following up on some of the reaction to the SB3 ruling, particularly the harsh attacks on the Judge Brown as being a politically motivated, a Democratic judge, in the words of one Republican official, and the implication this has for what has been a tradition of deference to judicial decisions in New Hampshire, even if you're on the losing side. And it's quite a trend to see a pattern here, as we see in other parts of the country, where the judges are being called to task on a political basis.
All right. Jeff?
Well, I know that next week I'll be paying attention to the last round of debates. I guess Channel 9 is doing them. Union leaders involved, and public radio is involved, I believe, as well. And especially the gubernatorial debate, which I think Molly Kelly has shown that she needs to step up her game a little bit in terms of going against the governor.
And Dean, what will you be watching?
These guys are both right. It's going to be all about campaigns and courts. Courts and campaigns.
All right. Well, yes, the NHPR is involved in that debate next week. NHPR's Casey McDermott will be a part of it. Remember, the conversation continues online about all these stories at nhpr.org and on Facebook. I want to thank Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review, and our regular panelist, Dean Spiliotis. Really appreciate you all being here. Thank you very much.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Peter.
That's it for today. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.